Okay, so I'll be talking with you today about the influence of peers and risk perceptions on distracted driving of teens as well as parents of teens. I'd like to recognize my collaborators who, without their help and experience and collaboration, I don't think this could have ever happened. I don't have any lucrative associations to disclose or any non-lucrative ones either. But I would like to acknowledge Toyota and the Collaborative Safety Research Center for providing funding for this research. So what is driver distraction? Well, here's one definition, very long, kind of complicated. By the time I get to the end of it, I forget what I read at the beginning. So we'll just cut to the chase. I'm defining it as any physical or mental activity that interferes with the driver's ability to safely operate a vehicle. Okay, physical or mental activity. As has been pointed out, distraction is not new. Distracted driving has, I would bet, been occurring ever since humans started operating vehicles. However, recently, there has been renewed interest in distracted driving, and in part, this has been motivated by increasing concern over technologies that are being introduced into the vehicle. And there are three classifications of technologies generally. There's the nomadic devices that you can carry into the vehicle with you, like your cell phone. There are aftermarket devices, like your Garmin or TomTom, that you buy and you stick to the windshield or put on the dash. And there is the original equipment. And increasingly, we're seeing more and more technology in motor vehicles across the board, but we are seeing more specifically, and maybe a greater concern, more technology that's there for the convenience of the driver and not for safety. Now, the manufacturers of these devices did not have reducing or limiting distraction in mind when they created the device. They wanted it to be convenient, they wanted it to be entertaining or helpful. They really weren't thinking about the distraction component. Just some background on distraction, it is a really significant problem. Estimates are that it contributes to up to 25% of crashes. In 2011, it was a factor in crashes resulting in the death of over 3,000 individuals and in non-fatal injuries of over 387,000. So these are big numbers. This is reason to be concerned. This is clearly a public health problem, and these numbers are most likely underestimates. Based on observational data, and this is some of the same data Bruce talked about, the 100-car study, we know that 80% of crashes occur while people are looking away from the forward roadway. Now, I bring up this statistic just because it really emphasizes how important it is to have your eyes on the road, because some of these glances away from the forward roadway were to check the mirrors, but they should be glances. Start looking for a second or 2 seconds, as Bruce mentioned, and the risks really escalate quickly. Also, 22% of near-crash events occurred when the driver was involved in a secondary task, some task other than just driving. Now, teen drivers were already at a disadvantage without being distracted because, by definition, they are novices. You all know these statistics. I'll just repeat them anyway. Crashes are the leading cause of death for teens, and they are one of the leading causes of non-fatal injury. Teens are disproportionately represented in motor vehicle crashes, teen drivers are, and it is the largest single contributor to lost quality-adjusted life years among teens. Reasons for this, one is immaturity, or another way to think of it is stage of development. Their adolescence is a time when sensation seeking is high and inhibitions against risk are relatively lower. That's one reason, one contributor that is linked to immaturity. But as I said before, they are novices. So by definition, they have not been driving much. They don't have experience. Because they don't have experience, they haven't developed the necessary skills to drive. Driving is a complex and multitask activity. And as experienced drivers, we kind of forget that because so much of it becomes automated. But for teens, very little of it is automated. And so the cognitive load for teens of just driving alone is much greater than it is for adults. So changing topics just a little bit. Social norms, what are they? Well, these are the social constructs that we have in our mind that tell us what is acceptable or unacceptable, and in which conditions or situations. They play a very important role in social learning. They provide us with models that we follow, models of behavior that we then imitate and integrate into our own repertoire. The theory of normative social behavior by Ramal and Real gives us a structured explanation or description of how norms function to influence behavior. And first and foremost, they say that descriptive norms are associated with behavior. Descriptive norms are the norms that we come to possess by observation. We see what people do. We develop some kind of normative expectation that, you know, people of a certain sex and a certain age and certain groups will behave in certain ways. Ramal and Real suggest that descriptive norms by themselves do not influence behavior very strongly because there's not a lot of motivation involved there. Just because you see people doing stuff doesn't mean that it's compelling for you to imitate. What they suggest is that normative mechanisms have to be involved, and they name three. One is injunctive norms. Injunctive norms are an individual's perception of important other people's expectations of them. So it would be my perception of how my wife expected me to drive or behave, or how my children, what my children expected of me. Now, injunctive norms are powerful because we think that we're going to increase, and we probably do increase social approval by adhering to these norms. Outcome expectancies is another category. How am I going to benefit? How much am I going to benefit? What are the risks? Is this going to help me gain entree into another peer group that I want to be part of? These are all outcome expectancies. And finally, group identity. How similar am I to the people whose approval I'm seeking? Or how much would I like to be more similar to these people? So this is the model that we use to guide the research I'm going to tell you about today, including the analyses that we conducted. So the purpose of this study was to examine the association of norms and risk perception with engagement in distracted behaviors while driving by teens and by parents of teens. We collected our data using a telephone survey. We had one sampling, national sampling frame, as well as sampling frames from six major media markets that we used to contact individuals. And within this sample, we have two independent samples. We have a sample of teenage drivers, about a little over 2,700. These are teens between the ages of 16 and 18 who are licensed to drive. We have a sample of parents of teen drivers, a little over 3,000 of them. So these are parents who have a kid who's between the ages of 16 and 18 has a license to drive. These are not the parents of the teens that were interviewed. They're not from the same household. They're not related, so they're independent. The other requirement that we had to have, just out of practicality, was that the respondents had to speak English well enough to complete a telephone interview. So the teen sample is about half male, half female. The majority of them, the largest group, was age 17, and most of them were in 11th grade, or at least that was the modal grade. Parents were mostly moms, Not a big surprise. The modal age group was 50 to 54. They typically had 4 years of college, 90% were married, and these families were middle to upper middle class, and 80% of the sample was white. So our dependent measure was the frequency of parents' and teens' involvement in distracting behaviors while they drove. There were 16 behaviors, and basically we asked them, during a typical trip while driving, how often do you do A, B, C, X, Y, Z? And they responded on a frequency scale. And so we summed those item scores, and that gave us our two dependent variables for this study. Here's some frequency data for those 16 items. These were people who reported doing the behavior one or more times per trip, per typical trip. A lot of numbers there, but I think the thing that really jumps out as you look at them is that the teens report doing more of everything. They report more of every one of these distracting behaviors. Now you'll see that the distracting behaviors range quite across the scope of severity and risk associated with them, and that was intentional. We didn't want to just sample the very worst. The independent measures were perceptions of peers and of risk, and they were based on the same 16 distracted behaviors. We asked the parents and the peers, or the teens, how often do your peers do each of these things when they drive? And then we asked them, how much do your peers approve of you doing these things when you drive? And then finally we said, how risky are these behaviors? And we divided these perceived risk variables into tasks that required you to take your hands off the wheel, eyes off the road, or both at the same time. So this will get to a question that was asked earlier. We felt that it's kind of difficult, I think, for people to judge risk. When you say how risky is something, what do they base that on? So instead of asking them how risky it was, we said, how willing would you be to do these things? And then we flipped the direction when we scored the variable. And in addition, for each of these items, we provided a context, because clearly texting at a red light does not carry with it the same level of risk as texting while in dense freeway traffic. So the hands-off wheel items are these five. You'll look at them and you'll say, well, you know, you kind of have to take your eyes off the road to do some of these. But the point here when we classified them was that you could do it in a glance. It didn't require a gaze away from the road. So you might look down to see, you know, where the environmental controls knob is, and you look back at the road and you reach for the knob. Eyes off road, again, these required hands to be taken off the wheel from time to time, but usually that was brief. It was not a major part of completing the task. And then both, things like texting, dialing a cell phone, it required you to look away from the roadway and use your hands off of the wheel. We analyzed the data using multiple linear regression with sequential models that were force-entered. In the first model, we entered the peer distracting behavior. Next, we entered the peer approval, and finally, the perceived risk. So these are the results for the parents. We see that when we entered the peer's distracting behavior, it was very significant statistically, but accounted for a very small proportion of parents' distracting behavior while driving. When we entered peer approval, the size of the effect for peers' behavior was reduced, but again, together these two variables only predicted about 11% of the variance in parents' behavior. When we entered the risk perception variables, the amount of variance predicted jumped up to about 20%, and peers' approval became much smaller, the coefficient did. So just hold that in your minds for a second. We'll look at the teens' results. We see that for the teens, peers' distracted behavior accounted for almost as much variance as the entire model for parents did. 19% of the variance. When we entered peer approval, again we see a decrease in the coefficient for peers' distracting behavior and just a small increase in the variance predicted. When we enter risk perception, we see that the variance predicted goes up by about two-thirds. And interestingly, I think, we see that peer approval becomes non-significant for teens when we enter the risk perception variables. And this probably is because what is perceived as risky is also perceived as being approved of among these teens and their peers. So, this study was not without limitations. The sample was not representative of the entire United States, but there's no reason to believe that it wasn't representative of teens who are licensed to drive and parents of those teens. It was self-report, and so we always try and protect ourselves a little bit when we do self-report work. There's good reason to believe that asking people to report their distracted driving behavior isn't going to be very valid. I mean, if they're really distracted, are they even going to remember? So what we did instead was ask people to report their typical behavior, which people generally can do a lot better. There may have been social desirability associated with distracted driving, so we never used the word distraction in the survey or any of its derivations. We always just ask them, how often do you do XYZ? Finally, we know, or you know, it makes sense that every time a person participates in one of these distracting behaviors, doesn't mean they're distracted. Not every time, but the more often they do it, I think it's safe to assume the more often they'll be distracted. Conclusions, norms are a very important influence on behavior, not just for teens, but for parents. parents and teens were obviously very aware of what their peers were doing, or at least they had a good idea of it. And peers' approval was actually kind of more influential for parents than it was for peers, or for teens. Risk perception is also very important, but more so for teens than for parents. And, you know, together, direct and injunctive norms and risk perception are stronger influences for teens' behavior. So implications, I think there's room here for interventions. Misperceptions around norms can be corrected by clear communication. Clear communication is facilitated by when parents and teens sit down and make a signed agreement. And in this case, it would need to be an agreement that they would work as a team to help each other reduce their distracted behavior while driving. So with that, I'll just end with this. Thank you.
Towards So
you get the award for the tough question.
Well, it's not meant to be tough. Is it something from Iowa, we're starting to look at traffic safety culture versus a single engineering or a single target population,
right?
Like just teens or just, you know, occupational drivers. So, just don't know where to go.
Right. Well, what I always say about intervention is you have to do everything, you know, because it's all related. Race findings, I think, are pretty interesting. Again, there are limitations to cross-sectional surveys. I don't think we should develop interventions based on cross-sectional data because that's really just hypothesis generating. Nevertheless, there's a lot of data that suggests that social norms measured a variety of ways are important. I didn't show you, but in the National Association of Teenage Driving study, the only individual characteristic that was associated with crash near crash rates and kinematic risky driving rates was measures of social norms. We asked it a couple of ways. One was we ask about the risky driving behaviors of their five closest friends. But if you ask them also in a separate items, asking about the non-driving risky behavior of their five closest friends, you also get associations. So what this reflects, I think, is social norms. So pretty much a lot of different ways that norms have been evaluated. That would suggest that a culture approach would matter. But changing culture has not proven to be that easy. And it seems like there are a lot of, we need to be very sort of multi-component, multi-level about it, because peer norms are not homogeneous. You know, there are peer groups that have their own norms. Nevertheless, the adolescent, their peers, seem like reasonable targets for intervention. Parents let you down when it comes to driving and in every other way. Parents are clueless about driving. And their norms, generally, are quite passive. And I think we can do more in that way to alter the culture. And then I think policy has a lot to do with culture. You know, when you have a strong GDL policy, that's an opportunity to change norms. Anyway, so that's a long, do it all. Just do it all.
I would add one thing. I think it's difficult. I mean, we look at other places where there's been a culture shift that's led to a lowering of risk, and a really good example is drinking and driving. But there's a big difference between drinking and driving and using a cell phone or being distracted and driving, and that is that it's really hard to enforce a law prohibiting distracted driving, even if it's something I think as obvious as texting or talking on a cell phone. One evaluation for the Insurance Institute showed evidence that after a texting ban was passed, crashes actually went up in the state. We are currently doing a policy evaluation of texting and cell phone laws, and the results, we're still in the process of analyzing the data, but they are very mixed. For some states, we see a very clear increase, uptick, when they pass the law prohibiting the behavior. In other states, we see a downtick. What does it mean? I don't know, but the enforcement piece that was such a big player in drinking and driving is probably not going to be there for distraction. So that's also tricky.
I have a question for Dr. Simmons. Is that in your analysis for the teen drivers, many of the tests were as risky or even riskier than the texting? And for example, reaching or eating was closed. So I was thinking, do you have any data? You have the data on the duration of the tests. For example, if somebody was reaching, how long they were reaching, and attributable risk, and look at that.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We have done an analysis of the duration of distraction and looked at a few different ways, but basically what we find is that the longer the distraction, the greater the likelihood of a crash. And if you're interested, I can. That paper is under review and will be going to be out soon. Going to be resolved soon, I'm sure. But the similar kind of thing was found in the 100-car study. Basically, the two-second rule shows an odds ratio of about 2. But with longer periods of distraction, the odds ratio swings up. But the confidence intervals also go up. So
you're saying that as the duration goes up, the odds ratio goes up. But then as the duration, so let's say odds ratio, I just drew relative risk. So because the duration is increasing and relative risk is increasing, the attributable risk is then a multiplicative effect on the attributable risk.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think part of the why confidence intervals is that people do, I think adults particularly, they do their distracting tasks under less risky driving conditions. So you get long glances off the highway only after they've made sure there's no other cars around and they're, you know. So I think there's some noise in the data.
University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute, looking at technologies that block cell phones when the car's in motion, and what they found, you know, wasn't really crystal clear results. It wasn't clear that it was that helpful necessarily, because what they found was people spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to trick the system, how to override it. So. Is technology the answer? I think it could be part of it, but I don't know if it's going to be the whole answer.
Just a couple of things to add. I mean, navigation, a lot of navigation systems have a blocking system already in place, so you can't easily change your destination while you're going. So I can see there's going to be that. But I also think there's going to be, you know, it's difficult because, you know, teens want their phones. But when you talk to parents, they want their teen to have a phone. They want their teen to be reachable at any moment. So I don't think it's going to be easy, but I think technology is going to be part of the solution.
Yes.
Sure, yeah, so I think that, I tried to make this point at the beginning, I think that generalizability is tough for any study because the policies vary, you know, from state to state, from population to population. So our focus was really to try to understand, you know, Utah specific drivers. So how the results would differ, you know, more generally, Utah's policies now are stricter, you know, than average. So my guess would be support for policies in other states would probably be a little bit lower since they're not as far along in that process. I would anticipate that the behaviors would be similar, at least from some of the national studies, but how they would compare to a specific state, you know, I'm not sure.
Thank you. Let's give the three presenters.